Blog Talk Radio.
Mama Milo Nipo to contend, Umbati Bakaja Hufika.
Mais chibango,
dois,
Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Friday, October 4th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast. Later on, we'll be coming up with our regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the ongoing fighting in the West Asian state of Lebanon. The United States is behind the escalation of the IDF aggression in Lebanon and other parts of the region. Tunisia and North Africa votes on Sunday for a president. And Senegal in West Africa turns towards traditional languages and away from French. In the second hour, we review more speeches from the United Nations General Assembly 79th session during late September. We'll have addresses from the Russian and Cuban foreign ministers, as well as the Prime Minister of Barbados. In the final hour, we look in detail at the situation in Lebanon. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take our musical interlude in the East African state of Kenya with the Winam Jazz Band. Let's listen in here at the Pan-African Journal.
Yeah. Dio me bagi maya niti mayudo luo por paro Yala bogo mwache kendo kelo bega tiwa kwelo mosmos Pinyo duogo pako gimaya niti momina nyango gomba Yamagoyo pako gimaya noti mourube uneno Uom titum kaisa wadeno ni mwalimu bwana Wapwende ojo tumbe kendo ti uneno kajo nyaso ngeyo to Yamagoyo pako gimaya noti mourube uneno Uom titum kaisa wadeno ni mwalimu bwana Wapwende ojo tumbe kendo ti uneno kajo nyaso ngeyo to
Thank you. Anuali dogi udoko ka upoti je korile kwa yupoti.
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast on this Friday, October 4th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. That was the music of the Wanam Jazz Band from the East African state of Kenya. Right now, we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. These are some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Newswire. Israeli occupation forces are suffering terrible losses in the occupied north as Hezbollah continue to confront, defy, and bombard their movements and sites on the border and beyond. The Islamic Resistance in Lebanon, Hezbollah, announced a series of relentless operations against Israeli occupation forces, sites, military vehicles, and settlements in support of the people and resistance in Palestine. In defense of Lebanon and as a response to the reckless Israeli aggression targeting both Gaza and Lebanon. On October 4th, 2024, Hezbollah carried out 23 declared operations so far. The resistance fighters targeted occupation soldiers, positions, and sites, as well as thwarted all infiltration attempts into the Lebanese territory. The Islamic Resistance carried out their operations, and these are some of the ones that have been reported. Bombarding the Rayat settlement north of Haifa with barrages of rockets. Targeting the Merkava tank in the vicinity of the Al Malakia site with a guided missile at dawn, setting it ablaze and killing and wounding its crew. Targeting the Israeli artillery emplacements south of Kiryat Shmona with a salvo of rockets at 9:15 this morning. There was a bombarding the Yania military base with a rocket salvo, targeting the occupied city of Safad with a rocket barrage, targeting an Israeli occupation force and its vehicles in the Maroun Al Ras plain with artillery shells at 11 a.m., dealing a direct hit and thus confirm casualties among the force. In other news taking place in the region, in Lebanon, in regard to Lebanon, Colonel Douglas McGregor admits during a podcast that Israel's aggression cannot take place without the full support and technical backing from the United States. What needs to be understood concerning Israeli aggression in Lebanon is that it could not have happened at all without us, former senior U.S. Defense Department official, military historian, and retired U.S. Army Colonel Douglas McGregor asserted. Israel has killed 1,974 people and wounded 9,384 others since the beginning of the Israeli aggression on the country since last year on October 8th and its expansion about a week ago. The retired colonel expressed during a podcast interview with Judge Andrew Napolitano that the U.S., along with its considerable ISR assets, the Air Force, and the U.S. Navy engaged in supporting the invasion of Lebanon by Israel, citing the U.S. capability of harvesting extremely sensitive information that Israelis would not be capable of retrieving on their own. McGregor affirmed that when such successful operations take place in Lebanon or other locations, quote, it is not an Israeli-only operation by any means, end quote, adding that even though this is a dangerous endeavor, the prime minister of the occupation, Benjamin Netanyahu, does not see it as such. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In the North African state of Tunisia, with his major opponents imprisoned or left off the ballot, Tunisian President Kais Saied faces few obstacles to winning re-election this coming Sunday, 5 years after riding anti-establishment backlash to his first term. The African North African country's October 6th presidential election is his third since protests led to the 2011 ouster of President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, the first autocrat toppled during the uprisings in North Africa, which took place in Egypt, Libya, as well as Yemen. Libya, of course, turned into a counter-revolution. International observers praised the previous two contests as meeting democratic norms. However, a raft of arrests and actions taken by a Saied-appointed election authority have raised questions about whether this year's race is free and fair, and the opposition parties have called for a boycott of the vote. And finally, in this segment of our program, in Senegal, for decades, Senegal, a former French colony in West Africa, has been touted as the bastion of the French language in the region. Leopold Sédar Senghor, the country's first president and a poet, is considered one of the founding fathers of the concept of Francophonie, a global alliance of French-speaking countries. But many say a shift is underway. While French remains the country's official language inscribed into its constitution, its influence is waning. It is giving way to Wolof, the most widely spoken local language, and not just on the street, where the latter has always been dominant, but in the halls of power, government offices, university corridors, and mainstream media. As the French president hosts the annual Francophonie Summit north of Paris, Senegal's president is not attending in person. He sent the foreign minister as his representative instead. Quote, Wolof is on the rise because Senegalese people want to be seen, unquote, said Adjetou Sall, a professor of linguistics at the Sheikh Anta Diop University in Dakar, who began researching the Wolof language in 1998. Quote, they want to detach themselves from the colonial heritage and reclaim their own cultural identity, unquote. There are 25 languages in Senegal. Six of them have the status of national languages, but Wolof is largely dominant. Out of the population of 17 million people, over 12 million speak Wolof compared to and around 4 million French speakers. With that, we'll conclude our Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this segment of our program, we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers and magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, all you need to do is go to our website, and that's at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And if you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast for Friday, October 4th, 2024, all you need to do is log on to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break, and we'll be back with more. Detroit's own Kim Weston with the track entitled Danger, Heartbreak, Straight Ahead. And we're going to go back to the United Nations General Assembly 79th session. This is an address delivered by Russian Federation Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Let's listen in to his address.
I now give the floor to His Excellency Sergei Lavrov, Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Russian Federation.
Distinguished Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, a few days ago, within this building, the forum entitled The Summit of the Future took place. Russia showed understanding to the Secretary General's idea to convene that summit, since the crisis of our organization is growing worse and something needs to be done about that. And we were involved honestly in the preparations for the summit, although, quite frankly, we didn't have any particular illusions about it. In the contemporary history of the UN, there have been many ambitious events that concluded with loud declarations that were quickly forgotten about. For example, in 2000, the Millennium Summit declared the task of freeing peoples from the scourge of war. Just 2 years after that, the USA, at the head of the Coalition of the Willing, under the laughable pretext, without a mandate from the UN Security Council, invaded Iraq, a country which has still not been able to recover from the destructive consequences of that escapade. In 2005, the UN World Summit declared a commitment to establishing a just peace in accordance with the principles and purposes of the UN Charter. This sacred obligation certainly didn't stop the USA and their allies from getting the then leader of Georgia, Mikhail Saakashvili, in 2008 to unleash an armed aggression against the people of South Ossetia and Russian peacekeepers. And a further 3 years after that, NATO organized the military intervention in Libya, destroying its statehood and undermining the stability of neighboring countries. In 2015, the UN Summit on Sustainable Development adopted grandiose plans to combat poverty and inequality, but they turned out to be empty promises in light of the reluctance of the countries of the West to refrain from their neo-colonial practices of mining the wealth of the entire world for their benefit. Just look at the statistics of the promises that were kept in terms of financing the development of the countries of the Global South and the transfer of environmentally friendly technologies. Just like Kofi Annan and Ban Ki-moon in the past, the current Secretary General advanced his own initiative under the slogan of rebooting global cooperation. It's an excellent slogan. Who could be opposed to that? But what global cooperation can we really talk about at a time when the West has trampled all of these unshakable values of globalization that they've been telling us about for so many years from this rostrum, trying to convince us that they would ensure equal access for everyone to the goods of contemporary civilization? Where is the inviolability of property, the presumption of innocence, freedom of speech, access to information, fair competition on markets with understandable and unchanging rules? The Secretary General is talking about global cooperation at the same time as the countries of the West have unleashed a veritable sanctions war against a good half, if not the majority, of states in the world. And the dollar, which was advertised to us as the heritage and good of all of humanity, has been grossly transformed into a weapon. For more than 60 years, there has been a trade blockade of Cuba, the cancellation of which the overwhelming majority of members of the international community are calling for in the pursuit of the ever more ephemeral aim of preserving their domination. Washington is blocking the normal work of the World Trade Organization on dispute settlement and reform of the Bretton Woods institutions, the structures of which for a long time now have not reflected the real balance of forces in the global economy and finances. The West also wants to transform the UN into a tool for advancing its mercantile plans. As was shown by the Summit of the Future, there are more and more attempts to erode the intergovernmental nature of the organization. Long necessary changes in the staffing of the Secretariat are being held back. Key posts in the Secretariat are now essentially occupied and handed down to representatives of the Western minority. If the Secretary General is calling for a reboot of global cooperation, then the Secretariat must advance unifying ideas and propose compromise options rather than coming up with excuses to introduce into the UN's work narratives that are beneficial to the West. Breathing new life into the UN, it's not too late to do that, but in order to do that, we can't have unrealistic summits and declarations. Rather, it must be done through rebuilding confidence and trust on the basis of the charter principle of the sovereign equality of all member states. However, as long as confidence is being undermined, for the time being it is, and the actions of the West to create in circumvention of the UN narrow formats that are subordinate to it to resolve subsidiary fateful issues such as internet governance and artificial intelligence. But those problems affect all the future of all of humanity, and they must be considered on a universal basis without discrimination or trying to achieve unilateral advantage. That is to say that there must be an honest negotiation involving all members of the UN rather than the way that the so-called Pact of the Future was prepared for, without a single plenary round of negotiations that all countries would be involved in. But instead of that, the work was carried out under the control of Western manipulators. As a result, the pact, even before it was born, had already joined the pantheon of declarations that sound nice in English. Sad as it is, that is the fate of products of these world summits. However, things aren't any better when it comes to implementing Security Council resolutions, which are binding. The sabotage of decisions on the Kosovo settlement and the Dayton agreements on Bosnia and Herzegovina says a great deal. But the most glaring example continues to be spinning out over almost 80 years the consensus resolutions on the creation of an independent Palestinian state coexisting in peace and security with Israel. There can be no justification for acts of terrorism, which Israelis fell victim to on the 7th of October last year. But everyone who still has a sense of compassion is outraged by the fact that the October tragedy is being used for the mass collective punishment of the Palestinians in the form of an unprecedented humanitarian catastrophe. The killing of Palestinian civilians with American weapons must immediately be ended. It is important to ensure the delivery of humanitarian aid to the enclave, the reconstruction of infrastructure, and most importantly, it is important to guarantee the realization of the legitimate rights of the Palestinians to self-determination and to allow them, not in words, but in deeds, as they say, on the ground, to create a contiguous and viable state within the 1967 borders with its capital in East Jerusalem. Another glaring example of terrorist methods as a means of achieving political aims is the inhumane attack on Lebanon that transformed civilian technology into a lethal weapon. There must be an immediate investigation into this crime, but already we cannot remain silent in the face of the many publications in the media, including in Europe and here in the United States, that indicate to varying degrees the involvement and at the very least awareness of Washington when it comes to the preparation of that terrorist attack. And we understand that the Americans always deny everything and they do everything they can to hush up any facts that come to light, as they did in response to the irrefutable evidence of their implication in the terrorist attack on the Nord Stream gas pipeline. Those gas pipelines, incidentally, were a marvelous symbol of that self-same global cooperation that our Secretary General dreams of. But as a result of their destruction, the competitiveness of the European Union in the global economy has been undermined for long years to the benefit of the United States. It is on the West's conscience as well that the truth about those who organized many other heinous crimes has been put on a back burner, including the bloody provocation in the Kiev suburb of Bucha and the series of poisonings of citizens of Russia in Britain and Germany. The UN Secretariat cannot remain separate from efforts to establish the truth in situations that directly impact global security, and in doing so is obliged to strictly observe Article 100 of the UN Charter, to act impartially and to avoid the temptation to play into the hands of individual states, particularly those that are actively calling not for cooperation, but to divide the world into the flowering garden and the jungle, or to those sitting around the table of democracy and those that are on the menu. We mustn't forget also about the service record of those that demand that their rules be implemented by the rest of the world. The invasion of Afghanistan and the inglorious 20-year presence there of the infamous coalition was accompanied by the formation of Al-Qaeda. A direct result of the aggression against Iraq was the creation of ISIL. Unleashing the war in Syria gave rise to Jabhat al-Nusra, which is now Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, and the destruction of Libya opened the floodgates for the permeation of terrorism into the Sahara-Sahel region and for the flow of millions of illegal migrants to Europe. We call upon all of those that are thinking about the future of their peoples and countries to be very wary of any new escapades by those who invented these rules. We are particularly concerned by the now almost commonplace practice of political killings, as once again took place yesterday in Beirut. The tragic and unacceptable turn of events in the Arab-Israeli conflict in Yemen in the Red Sea Basin, in the Gulf of Aden, Sudan, and other hotspots in Africa reflects an indisputable fact. Security can either be equal and indivisible for all, or it won't be for anyone. An understanding of what would seem to be a simple truth in the context of European security is something that Russia for years has been trying to impart to Washington, London, and Brussels, who are obsessed with their complexes of their own exceptionalism and impunity, although they initially promised not to expand NATO, and in 1999 and in 2010 they signed in official documents of OSCE summits an obligation to not ensure their security at the expense of others. In fact, the North Atlantic Alliance for three decades has been carrying out the geopolitical and military expansion of NATO into Europe. It is trying to take root in the South Caucasus and Central Asia, creating direct threats to the security of our country. And now the same is happening in the Asia-Pacific region, where NATO infrastructure is creeping in and to contain or deter China and Russia. Narrow military political blocks are being created that undermine the inclusive security architecture under the ASEAN umbrella, and the West is not only not remembering about the global cooperation that our Secretary General is such a fan of, but openly in their doctrine documents, they are harshly accusing Russia, China, Belarus, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, and Iran of creating threats to their domination. In respect of Russia, they have declared the aim of dealing it a strategic defeat, almost just like London and Washington planned in May 1945, with the development, even before the end of the Second World War, of an operation entitled Operation Unthinkable to destroy the USSR. Back then, this was kept top secret, but the current Anglo-Saxon strategists are not hiding their ideas. For now, they do, it's true, hope to defeat Russia using the illegitimate neo-Nazi Kiev regime, but they're already preparing Europe for it to also throw itself into this suicidal escapade. I'm not going to talk here about the senselessness and the danger of the very idea of trying to fight to victory with a nuclear power, which is what Russia is. Equally senseless are the Western backers of Kiev swearing that there is no alternative to negotiations based on the infamous peace formula. They are defending this doomed ultimatum by shamelessly invoking the UN Charter, demanding the territorial integrity of Ukraine be ensured. And I would like to recall, in particular, I'd like to remind the colleagues in the Secretariat that the Charter isn't just about territorial integrity. Charter 1 of the Charter declares the obligation to respect the principles of the equality and self-determination of peoples, and that served as the international legal basis for the process of decolonization, which incidentally still needs to be completed, however much the French, the British, and other former colonial countries may resist. In 1970, the General Assembly unanimously decided in its declaration that everyone must observe the territorial integrity of those states whose governments respect the rights of peoples to self-determination, and on that basis provide the entire population living on that territory. And I underscore that this was a unanimous decision of the UN General Assembly following long years of difficult discussions. There's no need to prove that Ukrainian neo-Nazis, having seized power in Kiev as a result of the US and allies supported bloody coup d'etat in February 2014, didn't and are not still representing the Russian population of Crimea, Donbass, and Novorossiya. The Western leaders, doing anything they can to talk about human rights, are in a very telling way staying silent about these rights when it comes to the racist actions of their clients in Kiev. In the light of this forgetfulness, I'll remind you about another requirement, again, in Article 1 of the UN Charter, the requirement to respect the rights and fundamental freedoms of any person regardless of race, sex, language, and religion. The rights of Russians and those that feel that they are part of Russian culture following the coup d'etat in Kiev have methodically been exterminated. The Russian language in Ukraine is banned by law in all areas, in education, the media, art, culture, and even in day-to-day life. Recently, another law was adopted banning the canonical Ukrainian Orthodox Church. These are gross violations of the rights of Russians enshrined in the UN Charter, and they bring with them threats to the security of Russia and all of Europe, stemming from the Kiev regime and those that are dragging it into NATO. And all of these are the root causes of the current Ukrainian crisis. It is to address these that is the aim of the special military operation that Russia is carrying out to defend its security and the current, present and future of the people on their native lands. We value the sincere aim of a number of our partners to advance, out of the best interests, mediation initiatives. We value their constructive results focus, unlike the hopeless Zelensky peace formula. We call upon our friends in their further efforts to take into account in full the facts that I have mentioned about the real reasons of this situation, the real causes of this situation. Unless they are addressed, a just UN Charter-based peace will not be possible. A realistic settlement plan was outlined by President Putin on the 14th of June when, once again, convincingly, he demonstrated Russia's goodwill when it comes to achieving negotiated agreements, the prospects for which were thrown out by Kiev and its backers as a result of the coup d'etat in 2014, the disruption of the Minsk agreements in 2015, and the Istanbul agreements of 2022. The unprecedented level of arrogance and aggressiveness of Western politicians against Russia simply not only nullifies the Secretary General's idea of global cooperation, but it is increasingly also blocking the functioning of the entire system of global governance, including the Security Council. That's not something we chose, and we're not responsible for the consequences of this dangerous course. However, if the West doesn't stop, there will be serious costs that will be felt by everyone. It is clear to the global majority that confrontation and hegemony will not resolve any global problem. They will only artificially hold back the objective process of the formation of a multipolar world order that will be based on the equal rights of large and small nations, that will respect the values of human identity, the equality of men and women, and the rights of peoples to determine their own fate. And incidentally, all of these are also quotes from the UN Charter, just like the principle of non-interference in the internal affairs of sovereign states as well. A confirmation of which, to the shame of the members of our organization, was blocked by the U.S. and their satellites at that very same summit of the future when the pact was adopted. Speaking on the 18th of September before the participants in the 4th Eurasian Women's Forum in St. Petersburg, President Putin underscored the need for a pooling of efforts in the name of sustainable development and general universal, equal, and indivisible security. Addressing the most complex problems facing all of humanity is something we can only do together, taking into account one another's interests. The West must realize this and refrain from its neo-colonial ideas. The Global South and the East are more loudly speaking about their rights and their fully-fledged participation in decision-making processes on the whole range of the international agenda, which is becoming particularly relevant in a situation in which the West is steadily destroying the model of globalization that they themselves created. The role of interstate associations in Asia, Africa, and Latin America is growing stronger, including the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the African Union, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean Countries, the League of Arab States, the Eurasian Economic Union, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, and others. The contacts between those regional integration structures are being established among themselves and also with the global association, the BRICS, which is creating opportunities for harmonizing approaches and agreeing on mechanisms for mutually beneficial cooperation and development that are not under the control of any negative external influence or diktats. All of these objective processes need to be taken into account in the work of the G20 as well, where the G7 is no longer able to pick the tune. We need to take a new look at ways of ensuring security in various regions, learning lessons from the sad experience of the functioning of the NATO-centric models, or the models, the so-called model of Euro-Atlantic security that the West has used to serve their own expansionist ideas. Russia advanced the initiative of forming an inclusive architecture of equal and indivisible security in Eurasia, which, and I wish to underscore this, is open for all states and organizations on our shared continent. We stand ready to work together to find mutually acceptable solutions, the use of interlinkages, and the natural competitive advantages of a single Eurasian space. This will be the subject of an international conference in Minsk that begins on the 31st of October this year. We are not stepping away from dialogue with the West. In July, upon the proposal of Russia, there was an open debate in the Security Council on the subject of building a more just, more sustainable world order. We believe it is important to begin the discussion that has begun in the UN as well as in other platforms. With a fairer world order undoubtedly requires the expansion of the representation of the Global South in the UN Security Council. We support our position in favor of the candidacies of Brazil and India, while at the same time taking a positive decision on the well-known initiatives of the African Union. However, of course, we cannot even talk about any additional seats for Western countries who are already excessively overrepresented within the Security Council. Distinguished ladies and gentlemen, May next year we will mark the 80th anniversary of the victory in the Second World War, during which the genocidal policy of the Third Reich killed tens of millions of people, including 27 million citizens of all of the peoples of the Soviet Union. These crimes do not have a statute of limitations, nor is any moral justification for those who are trying to whitewash Nazi executioners, collaborators, and their current adherents, be it in Ukraine, the Baltics, Canada, or in any other countries. Today, the world is facing extremely serious challenges that require a joining of forces rather than confrontation and a thirst for global domination. Russia will always stand on the side of collective work, on the side of truth and law, peace and cooperation, in the interest of giving rebirth to those ideals that were enshrined by the Founding Fathers. That is the aim of the Group of Friends in Defense of the UN Charter that was created upon the initiative of Venezuela. Its purposes and principles remain fully relevant. The most important thing is to make sure that absolutely everyone is guided by those principles, not selectively choosing from a menu, but rather in their entirety and as they are interlinked, including the principle of the sovereign equality of states. Then, working in favor of forming an honest balance of legitimate national interests, the legitimate national interests of all countries, we will be able to give life to the purpose of the UN that is enshrined in the Charter, to be a center for the harmonizing the actions of nations. Thank you.
I thank the Minister for Foreign Affairs of the Russian Federation.
Welcome back, and that was Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov of the Russian Federation speaking just last week at the United Nations General Assembly 79th session in New York City. Right now we'll listen to the Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez. Let's listen in on his address to the United Nations General Assembly 79th session that took place in New York City just last week.
I now give the floor to His Excellency Bruno Eduardo Rodriguez Paria, Minister for Foreign Affairs of Cuba.
Señor Presidente.
President, Secretary General, I dedicate these first words to reiterate Cuba's solidarity and support to the brotherly people of Palestine, victim of more than 75 years of colonial occupation, flagrant violations to their legitimate rights as a nation, submitted to cruelty, aggression, collective punishment, and apartheid. Over the last 11 months, the Israeli army has massacred more than 40,000 civilians. In that indiscriminate and disproportionate massacre, this has killed more boys and girls than men and women. They die with the complicity and weapons contributed by the government of the United States, with the complicit silence of others. We pay tribute to the more than 220 aid workers of this organization who have also been killed. Cuba's position is clear and unequivocal. President Miguel Díaz-Canel Bermúdez has said, and I quote, "History will not forgive the indifferent, and we will not be among them. The genocide against the Palestinian people must end unconditionally and without further delay." Israel, with the complicity of the United States, has brought the world to the brink of a major world conflict. The irresponsible aggression against Lebanon, Syria, Iran, and the people of the Middle East will have consequences that are hard to predict. Your Excellencies, 79 years after the establishment of this organization, the continued violations of the United Nations Charter and international law, aggressions, interference in the internal affairs of states, and the imposition of unilateral coercive measures for political purposes have become facts of life. Aggressive, expansionist, and supremacist military doctrines of domination are undermining international peace and security to an alarming extent. The risk of a nuclear catastrophe is real and imminent. For the 9th consecutive year, world military expenditure has continued to increase. In 2023, it reached the record figure of $2.44 trillion. That is to say, millions of millions of dollars. This includes the development of new nuclear weapons. There has been a regression in spite of the huge efforts made by states, parties, and signatories of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons and enlightened and broad sectors of international society. Nor will there be peace without development. Developed countries, which inhabit the very same planet, blindly refuse to invest even minimally in its own prosperity and security. They fail to comply with their always insufficient promises on official assistance for development. The selfish figure, boastfully promised in 2023 and quickly forgotten, represents less than 0.37% of their national incomes. The aspiration of achieving the Sustainable Development Goals has vanished. According to Forbes, just in the last 4 years alone, the collective wealth of the five richest people in the world has grown, while 5 billion people continue to live in poverty. The 1% richest in the world accumulate almost twice as much wealth as the rest of the global population. We're talking about 5 billionaires who, in this period, saw their wealth increase by some 423 billion euros, while the global population has got poorer. According to Oxfam, the 1%, the richest 1%, have accumulated almost double as much wealth as the rest of the world population. With a tax on the wealth of billionaires, 2 billion people could be brought out of poverty. We are talking about structural crises which are determined by the imperialist system and the international order imposed on us. None of these problems will be solved by undermining the intergovernmental nature of the United Nations, as some aim to, or by weakening its essential role in the promotion of sustainable development for all. Climate change is advancing inexorably. Climate change is an unquestionable fact. In July 2024, scientists announced that the planet had endured 13 straight months of record high temperatures. If the irrational and unsustainable production and consumption patterns of capitalism are not changed in an urgent and significant way, it will be impossible to limit the global average temperature increase by 1.5 degrees Celsius in comparison with pre-industrial levels. Responsibilities should be shared by all, but not all should bear the same responsibilities, nor is it fair for this to be so. However, a step in the correct direction could be taken at the COP29, which will be held in Azerbaijan, and we could adopt a new collective financing goal. The countries of the North will have a new possibility to begin closing the climate finance gap and pay their financing debts. We, the countries of the South, will have to design a sufficient goal that responds to our own needs with guarantees for development and social justice, despite the huge obstacles and challenges that we face. The solution will have inevitably to include writing off foreign debt, which has already been paid several times over. A fair democratic international order, ensuring peace and balance in the world. The exercise of the right to development by all states on an equal footing based on sovereign equality, strengthening the participation and representation of developing countries in decision-making and policy-making processes in the world. An order that guarantees the general good and prosperity of all peoples in harmony with nature and the sustainable management of natural resources to ensure the exercise of all human rights for all people. We need a new civilized coexistence among nations in which solidarity, international cooperation, integration, and the peaceful settlement of disputes prevail. This has to be an alternative to the philosophy of dispossession, war, the use or threat of use of force, aggression, occupation, domination, and the cultural, political, financial, technological, and military hegemony, or any other manifestation threatening the peace, independence, and sovereignty of states. An international order without unilateral blockades or sanctions, based on multilateralism, fully abiding by the United Nations Charter and international law. Madam President, the government of the United States has clearly continued to engage in the pernicious and unrealizable attempt to determine and control Cuba's destiny. It is an old ambition, anchored in the Monroe Doctrine, which defines the imperialist and hegemonic nature of the United States policy towards Cuba and the region of our America. The economic, commercial, and financial embargo is also a political, technological, and communication blockade. It has been conceived as one of its main weapons of aggression to destroy the Cuban economy. It aims to seek to cut off the country's financial revenues, to bring about the collapse of the economy, and to create a situation of political and social instability. The damage it causes is visible and undeniable. It has an impact on the daily life of all Cubans. It is accompanied by the most ferocious disinformation and slanderous campaign, perennial attempts to interfere in our internal affairs, and the complicit tolerance of groups which, from U.S. territory, perpetrate violent and terrorist acts against Cuba. These actions violate international law. They run counter to the purposes and principles of this organization and numerous resolutions adopted by this General Assembly. The siege so conceived has been reinforced with Cuba's inclusion in the U.S. State Department's arbitrary, shameful list of countries that allegedly sponsor terrorism. It is a fraudulent designation, void of any international authority or mandate. However, by virtue of this, reprisals of an extraterritorial character exceeding the sovereign jurisdiction of the United States are taken against Cuba and are manifested in and against any country. In May of this year, the U.S. State Department itself recognized that Cuba was fully cooperative with the United States with the international anti-terror efforts. This mere recognition of a universally established truth has not led to a relaxation of the unilateral coercive measures, but it does make the presence of Cuba on that illegitimate list to be ever more consistent, confusing, and unjustifiable. Soon, there will be new presidential elections in the United States. This is a matter that only is up to the United States citizens. It's only incumbent on the U.S. people, despite the nefarious and historical habit of the government of the United States to interfere in the elections and internal affairs of almost all member states of the United Nations, even its allies. History has taught us that no matter the results of these elections, the anti-Cuban sectors and politicians who have turned the attacks against Cuba into a profitable business will continue to be vocal and influential. They are the ones who have learnt to manipulate the U.S. political system to pursue a particularly narrow and hostile agenda, which is the interest of a well-defined elite sector. They do not in any way represent the will of the majority of the people of the United States, nor that of the Cubans who live here. Whatever the results of these elections, Cuba will continue to defend its sovereign right to independence and to build socialism the way we Cubans decide, without any foreign interference. we will also continue to advocate for a respectful and constructive relations with the United States. Madam President, in 2014, the community of Latin American and Caribbean states gathered in Havana decided to proclaim our region as a zone of peace. That historic commitment is becoming increasingly relevant every day. We defend peace and multilateralism against the unilateral coercive measures that seriously damage Syria, Belarus, Nicaragua, Venezuela, Zimbabwe, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Iran, Russia, Cuba, and several other nations. We strongly reject any attempt to undermine the legitimate constitutional order of our countries through putschist methods. It has already happened in Bolivia in 2019 and on the 26th of June, and there are attempts to do the same again in Honduras. We denounce the attempts to generate violence and destabilization in Venezuela. We reiterate our full support and solidarity with the Bolivarian and Chavista government headed by President Nicolas Maduro Moros and the civic and military unity of the Venezuelan people. The calls made not to recognize the electoral results are irresponsible and disrespectful to the people's will and their legitimate institutions. The destabilizing actions taken against the National Unity and Reconciliation Government of Nicaragua must also cease. The brotherly people of Sandino will continue to count on our full support. We reiterate our support to Puerto Rico's legitimate right to self-determination and independence. The international community has a historic debt to Haiti. Haiti carried out the first independence revolution against slavery in this continent. We welcome the efforts made by the Caribbean community to find a sustainable solution to the tragic situation in Haiti with respect for the independence and sovereignty of that sister nation. We support Argentina's legitimate right to sovereignty over the Malvinas, South Georgia, and South Sandwich Islands and the surrounding maritime areas. We reaffirm our support and commitment to the peace efforts in Colombia, which Cuba will continue to contribute to in every possible way from its position as guarantor. Africa, the cradle of humanity, will always be able to rely on Cuba's support in its efforts to move towards the goal of development. We reaffirm our unwavering solidarity with the Sahrawi people and their self-determination. Cuba strongly rejects the measures aimed at harming the territorial integrity and sovereignty of the People's Republic of China. We condemn the interference in its internal affairs, and we reiterate our unswerving support to the One China principle, as was decided by this General Assembly in its historic resolution 2758, which recognized the People's Republic as the one and legitimate representative of the Chinese people. We are in favor of a serious, constructive, and realistic diplomatic solution by peaceful means to the current war in Ukraine. And this must be in line with international law. guaranteeing the security and sovereignty of all. In this context, Cuba supports the joint proposal presented by Brazil and China to find a political solution to that crisis. Madam President, distinguished delegates, let us join together our efforts to achieve effective multilateral institutions which are able to respond to the interests of the people, of the humble, the poor, the needy, and the exploited. They are the overwhelming majority, based on just equality, the exercise of human rights by all human beings, and respect for the sovereign rights of every nation. Thank you very much.
I thank the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Cuba. I now give the floor to His Excellency Enrique Austria.
Welcome back. And that was the Cuban Foreign Minister, Bruno Rodriguez, speaking at the United Nations General Assembly, 79th session, just last week. And right now we'll move into another address, this one by the Prime Minister of the Caribbean island nation of Barbados, Mrs. Mia Motley. She also addressed the UN General Assembly 79th session in New York City last week. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for this Friday, October 4th, 2024. And we're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank
in the midst of this maelstrom, we were very clear. My country took the step this year of recognizing and establishing diplomatic relations with the state of Palestine in spite of having supported a two-state solution since 1969. And we did this because it is clear to us that the state and people of Palestine, human beings, are entitled to full recognition by integration into and support from the international community. The Charter does not say we the people, with the exception of any one group from any one part of the world. We join with others, therefore, in congratulating the State of Palestine and taking their seat among the United Nations member states as they did on the 10th of September of this year. And let me be clear, we condemn the actions of Hamas on October 7th, but we equally and strongly deplore the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, which is the result of the disproportionate use of force by Israel. There's no justification for it.
Here's a reminder to please like and share the video and subscribe to our channel to watch more videos on Africa's geopolitics, economy, and changing landscape. We have decided to bring videos on something nobody talks about: African politics, economy, and increasing power. Let's continue now.
We need a reset. And we need to reset. Mr. President, in your absence, I congratulate you on your assumption of this chairmanship of the General Assembly. We can't wait. As I said, Mr. President, we need a reset, and we need to reset. Those of us here today representing our brothers and our sisters the world over have endured 4 years of polycrises. As the children of Mother Earth, we continue to wrestle with the climate crisis. As a human family, we grapple with the legacy of the pandemic. As a digitally connected people, we are now, regrettably, confronted by multiple theaters of war and scenes of horror and famine flowing from that war, armed conflict instead of pursued development. Citizens of every country as well, struggling to contain the rising cost of living and the implications for them and their families on a day-to-day basis. And Mr. Speaker, Mr. President, we are all now threatened by the second but silent pandemic of antimicrobial resistance, together with a growing incidence of death and disability from chronic non-communicable diseases. We cannot afford the distraction of war. If ever there was a time to pause and to reset, it is now. Collectively as an international community, and individually as leaders in each of our countries, we must now deliver new opportunities and solutions to these crises which dampen economic growth, which restrict the ambitions of our people and numb our sense of the beauty and goodness that the world ought to be offering because it has it to offer. The reset for which I am calling, and indeed all of our citizens are demanding, must see an end to all forms of discrimination. That rules and institutions today exist which create first and second class citizens, as we have said from this podium year after year, depending on your nation of origin, militate against the trust and the credibility and the hope, and it fosters a crisis of confidence in the existing international order, which must become inclusive and responsive for all. More than any other complaint from this podium has been the disparity in treatment and the inability to be able to have fair and transparent treatment for all that would lead to the trust necessary for us to solve the problems of our times that are truly beyond man-made causes. Neo-colonialist structures that perpetuate and reflect an old world order characterized by racism and classism and misogyny, while ignoring the legitimate aspirations of billions, will not help to foster the hope or trust that is necessary to meet these polycrises. We must ensure that the global institutions give developing countries, especially small vulnerable states like my own, or vulnerable middle-income countries, seats at the table of decision-making where we can be seen, heard, become active agents in our own cause and lead our own development paradigms. My friends, we are reminded that 2024 is the final year of the United Nations Decade for the People of African Descent. Much has been achieved, but the recognition, the justice, and the development for people of African descent that was promised by this decade has, to say the least, not yet been fully realized. And it is for this reason that the Caribbean community joins the growing chorus, and my own country in particular, for the immediate proclamation of a second decade to complete the unfinished work and address the matter of reparations for slavery and colonialism. I start here because this is a necessary but complex conversation, and the Caribbean community is resolute that it must happen. Its resolution lies, and I want to be very clear, its resolution lies in a multi-generational approach, in the same way that the £20 million sterling debt that was incurred by the British government only was repaid in this 21st century, almost 200 years later, so that the notion of unaffordability becomes a non-issue once we recognize that the solution to reparations must be multi-generational and grounded in development. Mr. President, of necessity, the reset must also be characterized by institutional reform, which has to start in the United Nations councils. These councils suggest that some are full members, and others are only part members, and some may be part-time members, and some may be occasional members. All of this has no place in the 21st century. And the anger and the mistrust of our citizens and institutions, in leaders in multilateralism and in the processes which exclude while yielding much talk and little action is very real. And nowhere is reform and consequentially trust and hope more important to the well-being of billions of people today than in relation to the global financial architecture. Restricted access to capital, its disproportionately high cost, barring us from doing that which we must. Its inadequate scale and the overwhelming burden of debt often imposed on us by circumstances beyond our control. These are all now combining to force governments in the world's poorest countries and, frankly, across many vulnerable middle-income countries to devote more resources to debt service than to health and education, and in some instances, even infrastructure. For far too many members of the human family, cold ground is our bed and rock is our pillow. Too many go to bed with their bellies hungry, and too many may not even have a bed. Our reset must therefore collectively build a common agenda that reflects and reinforces our shared humanity. It is that shared humanity that binds us together. Mr. President, you know better than most. Our African brothers and sisters got it right with the principle of Ubuntu and have used this principle, this General Assembly, to remind us that its simplicity is what we should aspire to. I am because you are. I am because we are. My well-being is tied to yours, and our collective well-being is connected to Mother Earth. This best voices the approach needed to give expression to the reset that is absolutely necessary. And we acknowledge that there are glimpses of hope. We have, for example, on Monday, agreed to a pact for the future, but we still have war. We have agreed on a global digital compact, but we still have raging pandemics in the slow motion silent pandemic. All of this rests, my friends, on the common agenda that the Secretary General had set out for us before. Yesterday we agreed in a high-level meeting on a political declaration on antimicrobial resistance. A lot of fancy words, but this is where the rubber hits the road, because all of us in this room know people who have died from infections and for whom the antibiotics simply are no longer effective, so that within 48 hours a person's life is snuffed out almost as if they were at war. My friends, following on the intervention of the Bridgetown Initiative and the Paris Pact for People and Planet, the efforts of many across the board, we acknowledge that there is some hope, and it is evident in the beginnings of the reform that we are seeing little by little, but nevertheless they have started. These are all important steps, but we cannot take our eyes off the prize. Barbados has called for a fundamental reset, includes attitudes and behavior as much as actions or reforms. Heads of government are in agreement that we must trigger national development agendas of transformation with both speed and scale. We have a date with destiny against 1.5 degrees. We know that that is what is needed to survive, and the implications for people, even as we speak, can be dire. But if there is a failure to act with clarity of purpose, and if the political will retards progress on the front of the much-needed reform within the international financial institutions, purely because heads of government do not speak to ministers of finance when they reach Washington, D.C., or their board directors, if there is a need for that to be dealt with, then, my friends, there must be a commitment to be equal to the current challenges of member states if we are not to perpetuate the discriminatory practices that result in undermining the transformational opportunities that we need. Depriving vulnerable countries from being able to access concessional income that is long enough to build the resilience to save lives and to protect livelihoods is unjust. And that is why we must remain focused. That is why, my friends, we launched yesterday the third iteration of the Bridgetown Initiative, which identifies three key principles, very simply. One, we must change the rules of the international financial system and reform its governance and instruments. Two, we must shockproof vulnerable economies by dealing with debt and liquidity in a comprehensive development-focused manner. And if we need to give countries a shot of liquidity like we give them a shot of adrenaline to avoid them falling off the cliff of debt, then we must do so. And thirdly, we must augment financing by boosting country capacity to invest in resilience by several means, including what has been announced already, the rechanneling of special drawing rights through our multilateral development partners, but that will only be truly effective if there is another issuance of SDRs in the near future. Indeed, we must also address the challenge, and this I believe to be the fundamental mission of this generation, of how we are going to secure the global public commons to be able to maintain our safety and stability as a global community. We're going to have to discuss how we can secure it, and of course, how we must finance it. And that is not only the climate crisis or the loss of biodiversity that we speak about, but the other many global challenges that can truly destabilize countries and regions. Mr. President, these considerations are of fundamental importance to the sustainable existence of our generations, future generations. The SIDS agenda is another story of promises made but not kept. 30 years ago, the international community gathered in my own country to take action for the first time on the unique challenges faced by small island developing states. We birthed in my home country the first ever global agenda for small island developing states, which became known as the Barbados Program of Action. I thank Mauritius for its strategy of implementation, Samoa for its pathway. They were carriers of the baton of a development agenda for small island developing states in the intervening years, in the face of multiple global crises from health to climate to finance. The vulnerabilities, yes, of our countries as small states have become more pronounced. In May of this year, we gathered in Antigua and Barbuda for the fourth international conference on small island developing states. And I call on the international community and the multilateral system to let us work together to ensure that the promise created in Bridgetown in 1994 is delivered and realized through the Antigua and Barbuda agenda for SIDS 2024, otherwise known as ABAS. Let me use this opportunity as well to inform you that 2 days ago we took over the presidency of the Climate Vulnerable Forum, the V20 countries of the world, from Ghana, whose president I would like to thank for the excellent stewardship of the group over the past 2 years and indeed for the strengthening of its institutional capacity. The priorities of our term as chair of the V20 countries will be the multiple dimensions of climate crisis, dealing with them, the impact of the climate crisis on human health, and of course, the issue of debt and climate, because if we don't solve that, we cannot take the appropriate actions to deal with climate. I invite all United Nations members who are not yet members of the V20, but who are climate vulnerable, to join this group, because it is only through amplification of our voices and consistency of our message and solidarity that we will continue to see the pace and scale of reforms that we need to be able to save our people's lives. I commend to you the declaration of the leaders of the Climate Vulnerable Forum that was adopted this week on Wednesday. Mr. President, above all else, we need a global reset on peace. There needs to be global peace. And those of us who are old enough would have recognized that there are peaks and valleys as it relates to this issue of conflict. There are few areas where the world is more in need of the United Nations acting as the United Nations to secure the objectives of the Charter than in the area of peace and security. The silence that has engulfed Sudan is unacceptable and may well be rooted in the racism that the world still carries as a badge of honor from the victories of the last great war of the World War II. The actions in Myanmar cannot continue. Ukraine has sucked more oxygen out of the global community and the global financial system than any of us can appropriately accept at the very time when the world needs to be applying its resources and efforts to fighting the greatest crisis known to mankind. And the spread of the war from Gaza to the consequences in the West Bank to now clearly what is happening in Lebanon as we speak with Israel, all of these are but the tip of an iceberg of death, violence, and instability, and robs the global community of oxygen and resources at the very time when we need it most in a strategic way. We all know, as students of history, that even the longest war in history came to an end. These wars, yes, they too will come to an end. But the question is when and at what cost, and without much loss of life, with how many children not being able to be either given the chance to live or will now live with memories of war that will affect their every action for the next 60, 70, 80 years of their lives. Innocent people are paying the price with the one thing that is theirs to give, and they don't give it willingly. It is their life. Unless we address the root causes of these wars, one by one, and the manners in which they are being sustained and financed, we will never, never know anything else other than war and rumors of war in these theaters. The transmittal of these scenes of horror in real time into people's bedrooms, into people's living rooms, will trigger two extreme reactions, neither of which are acceptable to us in the third decade of the 21st century. We will either get the desensitizing of ordinary people to the loss of lives, especially those of innocent children and women on the one hand, or we will get on the other hand the anger and inclination for vengeance that it spawns necessarily. We need peace. And it cannot be too difficult for us to work for peace. It is the same Bible that tells us in the stories of the Old Testament much which has guided many people across this world. But when we turn from the Old Testament to the New Testament, it is Romans that says to us, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, not any country, not any human being." So that the Bible can't be used as a convenient aid when it suits us, and rejected when it doesn't. In the midst of this maelstrom, we were very clear. My country took the step this year of recognizing and establishing diplomatic relations with the state of Palestine, in spite of having supported a two-state solution since 1969. And we did this because it is clear to us that the state and people of Palestine, human beings, are entitled to full recognition by integration into and support from the international community. The Charter does not say we the people, with the exception of any one group from any one part of the world. We join with others, therefore, in congratulating the state of Palestine and taking their seat among the United Nations member states as they did on the 10th of September of this year. And let me be clear, we condemn the actions of Hamas on October 7th. But we equally and strongly deplore the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, which is the result of the disproportionate use of force by Israel. There's no justification for it. And that is why treaty...
Welcome back. And that was excerpts from an address delivered by Barbadian Prime Minister Mia Motley just last week at the United Nations General Assembly. 79th session, which was held in New York City. And we're reviewing a number of the speeches from the United Nations General Assembly. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast for Friday, October the 4th, 2024. And we're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. And, of course, this is the Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with our concluding segment of our program. Detroit's own Anita Baker with the track entitled Lately. And of course, in Lebanon, the Israeli Defense Forces, backed and coordinated with the United States Pentagon, has escalated their aggression. Nearly 2,000 people have been killed over the last year as a direct result of the anti-liberation movement forces in Israel, as well as the United States and its allies within the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. We want to listen to a panel discussion directly from Lebanon on the situation
inside
the country.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Cradle News Roundup, your one-stop shop for all news West Asia. My name is Esteban Carrillo, and I'm the head of news for the Cradle. As usual, I'm joined by my colleagues, content creator and social media manager for the Cradle, Sima Itaim, and columnist and editor for the Cradle, Sharmin Narwani. Before we start, we want to thank you for sharing, for liking, for subscribing this podcast, and please check out our Patreon where you can support the Cradle. We are 3 days removed from the assassination of Hezbollah chief Hassan Nasrallah in a brutal attack in a heavily populated area of Beirut, in which Israeli jets dropped anywhere between 80 and 100 heavy bombs provided by the United States, destroyed several buildings, and killed Hassan Nasrallah, killed an IRGC official, and, well, leveled this area of the city. Lebanon has been under very intense attack over the past couple of weeks. It started, in a way, with the pager attacks, right, when Israel bombed set off about 5,000 communication devices across the entire country. They started to conduct strikes deeper into the country, targeting, you know, what they like to say, Hezbollah positions, leaders, etc. Climaxing, in a way, with this horrific attack. Hundreds of people have been killed just over the past couple of weeks. We're talking about 700 people killed here in Lebanon, thousands injured, up to a million displaced across the country. And well, it's a new world, in a way, for Lebanon, for the resistance axis, and for Israel as well, because they are obviously turned the page, and they have obviously showing the entire world that they no longer have any limits, red lines don't exist, and it seems like everyone and everything is a target. So where does Lebanon go from here? Where does Hezbollah go from here? And what do we make of all of this?
I think more than one thing is true at the same time. We've discussed, all of us, before that, you know, Israel's assassination policy doesn't ultimately, you know, strategically make a difference
on the ground.
On the ground, but you know, it doesn't make the blow any easier when it's somebody like Hassan Nasrallah, which is, you know, a man larger than life, really. And you know, we're not here to do an obituary for him, because I think if people know or want to know more, it's very easy for them to know more. But so we know this. We know this from the time when Secretary General Abbas Mousawi was assassinated and Nasrallah took his place. And at the time, analysts and media were saying that it's the end of Hezbollah after Abbas Mousawi was assassinated. And now the media is doing the same thing, you know, and it's simply not true. But that doesn't make the blow easier. And we know this. We know this from Hamas, you know, Ahmed Yassin, Abdel Aziz al-Bantisi. We know this from the PIJ, Fatah Shekhasi, people who were always felt to be irreplaceable. The resistance is not built in that way. So that's not really, you know, I think that's not something up for dispute. But I think that, you know, things will change. You know, this brutal attack came after Netanyahu's UN speech, in which he, you know, he once again proposed the new Middle East and showed the map of the countries of the resistance axis as the curse. And, you know,
Israel and all the normalized nations.
Israel and the normalized nations as the blessing, right?
Mm-hmm.
With that road.
Yes.
That leads from, you know, oh, the land route. The land route. Yeah. And talking about all these new things that come along with an integrated Israel into the region, and Israel and Saudi normalization, and this land route, and this, you know, defeat, supposedly, of Hamas and Hezbollah for the sake of the Western civilized world. And yeah, I'm not here to discuss, you know, what Hassan Nasrallah means to Lebanon or to Palestine or to the Axis or to many people around the world. But I just want to say one thing before we get into other stuff, which is that We don't need a report or an analysis to tell us that he was at this time assassinated because he refused to separate the Lebanese front from the Gaza front. And, you know, we don't need a report for that. The ABC News came out and said Israeli officials said that they had to assassinate him because he refused to separate the two fronts. And we Israelis were trying for a very long time to reach diplomatic solution. He refused. I believe that. Of course, there are many benefits, perceived benefits for Israel to assassinate him. But at this time, when in his last speech, he challenged them directly and said, "You will not be able to return the settlers to the north, and the fronts will not be separated."
Yeah, you know, back to Netanyahu's decision when he was at the UN, it was, you know, the Israelis put out a photo of him making the phone call to kill Nasrallah, and here he was at the UN, not just any time and not just any place. This is the body where international law is made. This is the, you know, where the UN Charter was devised, to underpin sovereignty and territorial integrity as an absolute, foundation of the new order. But he did this photo off, and it showed that Netanyahu, who was there at the time where all world leaders had congregated, was above them. Here he is sitting in the seat where international law is created, with every world leader there, and he, the chosen one, decides to do something this obnoxious and in violation of all treaties and conventions and law. It is, again, man's strategy. Israel going to friends and foes alike and showing them that there's nothing they can't get away with. But in terms of, you know, what's changed, I think the most important thing that will have changed that we will see in the days ahead is until now, so until 11 months into this war, the entire resistance axis had sought to get Israel to stop its war on Gaza, at the same time seeking to halt any escalation into regional war. That has changed. There is no longer any attempt going to be made as Israel, you know, comes like a raging bull at its neighboring countries. So that strategy, while it worked for a long time, you know, as Israel was slowly taking incremental hits during these 11 months, Israel decided that it needed to take the initiative and needed to take the lead to change the dynamic of this war, which it did. It did very successfully, although entirely illegally. But the outcome of this will actually release the axis from that hard strategy that they cleaved to for 11 months, which was do what you must, but don't let this escalate. Now that's off the table. And Israel, you know, really in 2 weeks took the lead entirely. They were being led before, you know. Now they took the lead, but, you know, like Nasrallah and others have said in the Axis, you win some, you lose some. It's the important thing is who comes out victorious at the end of the war. And they have calculated from the beginning that this is going to be a long, protracted war, a war of attrition, which Israel cannot sustain because that is the nature of Israel's military strategy from day one of the existence of the state. There are several narratives that have emerged. One is the narrative that Hamas and Hezbollah are now defeated. Please, folks, don't even reply into this for a second. I say this because here at the Cradle, we reported in, you know, numerous podcasts since we got this think tank report, several think tanks, which CNN reported on, that Hamas has 24 battalions and 21 are operational. And the other three are in the process of regrouping. So, you know, Hamas has a leader, Yahya Sinwar, as you saw very swiftly after the killing of the previous leader, Ismail Haniyeh. If Sinwar is out of the picture, you know, there will be someone else. Same with Hezbollah. I mean, we have heard that the entire leadership of Hezbollah has already been replaced and decided upon, though that has not yet been confirmed by Hezbollah. But this is what we've heard from Hezbollah's closest allies. This is the nature of an institution. This is not a ragtag guerrilla group. This is not the asymmetrical warfare of the 1980s and the 1990s, this is a whole different era. So, you know, as Israel says, you know, we cut off the head. And there's 1,000 people waiting for these positions. Interestingly, people who are more qualified than ever before because of the Syrian theater and what that did in Hezbollah's organizational and military transformation. I mean, operationally, in terms of being battle tested, in terms of reconnaissance, in terms of communications, the Syrian battle brought up an entire generation of fighters into potential leadership roles, but, you know, there's too many of them and too few seats. So the seats will never remain empty. Anyone who says Hezbollah and Hamas have been defeated is, you know, should wait a few weeks.
He's trying to push a narrative.
And there was also, you know, to what you were saying about the Syrian theater, which is very true. And I mean, none of us here know exactly what happened. We may not know for a long time. But this idea also of, you know, the communications being infiltrated and to what extent that is true and how long that's been going on. And, you know, the pager attacks and walkie-talkie attacks up until today and months prior to that. There's a reports now been going around that Hezbollah's involvement in the Syrian war, which, you know, was well justified, as we all agree, was what made them vulnerable to this infiltration. And I'd like to know what, you know, your thoughts are on that.
Yeah. I know the bigger organization gets, right, the more facilities it occupies, the more production lines it has, the more rank and file that are doing basically civil types of jobs for the organization, the more opportunity there is for infiltration. I think when the pager attack happened, that was the first thought. Then it became, no, it's technology. I think all of these things are combined. I don't think anymore that there's like some super mole, because it's very clear that even a super mole would not know the locations of each and every one of these people at you know, all times of the day and night. I do think that since October 8th, when Hezbollah and Israel got into direct confrontation, that Israel has been able to use the facilities and technology of how many countries?
I mean, at least 59 intelligence agencies around the world at Israel's disposal. So that's why this narrative that one guy gave them up, when it's, like you said, this combined effort.
And because Lebanon is still a small country, and because there's been very accelerated activity since October 8th, it's harder to hide the movements, right? So if you manage to identify one and then very carefully follow one who is now in way more meetings, right, because they don't communicate in traditional ways anymore, certainly the commanders of the organization, then you are going to lead to another one, another one, another one. So I believe that through not some sci-fi technological device that we've never heard of, but rather through intense reconnaissance with the help of pretty much everybody, you know, the most technologically advanced countries, that they were able to slowly map out all these commanders, all the places they went, when the most important ones were coming together in one place, therefore identifying the way, way, way deep underground command centers, et cetera. But as we've also seen, Hezbollah hasn't missed a beat. It does continue at the same level prior to this assassination to hit Israel in sensitive areas. But now, the big question is, will this change? Because for sure, it's a war now. You know, so of course, avoiding the regional war, the old thing, you know, doesn't exist anymore. Now we're in a war. Iran has made a lot of comments just in the last day or two that this cannot go unanswered, and have suggested that they will be part of the answer and that they will never leave the resistance alone. At the same time, Iran does consider that every part of the Axis is fully capable still, which means, why intervene when its partners are still capable? And this is something that the Lebanese and supporters of the resistance here and others will be debating. Well, Iran should get involved, Iran should get... No, Hezbollah is not neutered in any shape or form. And let's remember that Israel has hit thousands of targets in what it calls its target back, that it's quietly amassed over these 11 months.
Israel claims to have hit them all, but Israel can only hit what it knows. And Hezbollah has only shown its low-level munitions, right? Its older munitions. And those can be hit. The question is, has Israel any idea about the sophisticated missiles, the guided missiles, the ballistic missiles, which Hezbollah has not used yet? Because they have to shoot off these things for them to get, you know, whether it's heat detection, et cetera, to get a lock on where this missile was fired from.
But here's the thing, you know, about Israel's intelligence gathering capabilities that they've displayed over the past couple of weeks, that they're nothing to be scoffed at, first of all. You know, I think the Pager's attack was more than enough evidence. Killing Nasrallah, I think, also serves as evidence that they, you know, this report that you're referring to, Sima, about the Syrian theater kind of opening up Hezbollah to be infiltrated, I guess. They talk specifically about the amount of data that Israel has collected over the years. They talk about Unit 9900, saying that they have programmers, I guess, writing algorithms that sit through terabytes of visual images that are collected by the drones of Israel, of the intelligence agencies that are just constantly being fed. So they know, right? Like all of a sudden, they identify an operative. Could it be a low-level operative? Could it be mid-level? Could it be, you know, senior level? The moment, you know, that they change their routine, what does that mean? Where is it going? They are constantly looking at Lebanon. They are constantly looking at everywhere, right? They're listening. They're listening through devices. They're listening through phones, through smart TVs, through car radios. Again, you know, they put bombs into people's pockets without them even knowing.
If you remember, in 2006, they actually tried to assassinate Said Hassan at least two or three times and failed. And it was actually since then that they changed their approach to intelligence gathering. And so then the Syrian war started and we went through that time, and that was when they had changed their approach. And a lot of things in that report about how, you know, their intelligence gathering was boosted, you know.
There's this attempt in Western media, this assassination of Hassan Nasrallah at first, trying to sow division. You know, we're all we all saw the reports talking about an Iranian mole that we hear about. You know, it wasn't Syrians, it was not Lebanese, it was somebody, you know, called and said Hassan was on his way, et cetera, et cetera.
But that, while that may apply absolutely to its success in assassinating most of the main heads of Hezbollah, it doesn't apply to the Hezbollah's military capabilities, again, because Hezbollah has not shown the most of its newer stuff that it has. The Israelis are unable yet to identify those. And, you know, a lot of things will change within the Axis now, and we don't know what any of those things are. But, you know, Naim Qassem, the Deputy Secretary General of Hezbollah, spoke just an hour or so ago, and he made clear that what we are doing on the battlefield today, okay, is still the minimum of our capabilities. It's part of the reason why when people were saying, why didn't you escalate against Israel all along these 11 months? They understood that they didn't want to show those. They didn't want to show the launch pads for these things. They didn't want to provide the heat detection and the signals, you know, that Recon can capture on these things. They're saving it for when they needed to do. And we have to, you know, Israel is winning in terms of winning loss in the battle scene only. Israel in the last 2 weeks is winning the PR war, but Israel is all about public relations in its warfare, whereas the Axis is all about strategy. Once that locks into your brain, you will understand so many things working backward from new information. So, you know, now the question is, what is Hezbollah waiting for? If it's only using its minimal capabilities, has so much more capabilities, it's re-established its command, its top command, ready to go. What is it waiting for? One of the things it's possibly waiting for is a ground invasion, okay, in which they can, you know, the Hamas and the Palestinian resistance took Israeli prisoners in which to exchange, but we're, you know, for Palestinian prisoners in Israeli detention. But in this case, you could have up to 10,000 Israeli soldiers in Lebanon, which gives Hezbollah a massive, massive hand. And that may be what it's waiting for, and maybe keeping things on a low boil because the Israeli, especially Netanyahu Center, are just bursting with confidence right now, bursting with bravado, which may in fact, and they're talking about today, about some have already said the ground war has already started. They've started to infiltrate the border. We don't know if that's true. We're not hearing.
They're saying they've entered as well at tunnels as well.
Whatever they're saying. The point is, the more the merrier. In Hassan Nasrallah's last speech, he said, you want to launch a ground war? Please come. You have no idea how we're ready for that. So this would be maybe part of the low boil. I want to go into something. There's a lot of propaganda here. So Israel's thing, don't forget, is always a PR war. It's not just for its domestic constituents. It's to amplify and power project in this region that it considers so dangerous for it, and globally, so nobody questions Israel's action or takes steps against it. So feeding propaganda, for sure dividing the Lebanese population by seeding paranoia, by seeding, about spies, about who's working in opposition, about security. These are going to be absolutely the kinds of things we're going to be hearing. We are going to see reams of, U.S. articles where they seem to have the intimate details of every Israeli operation, and the commandos came in, they snuck in at 12:04 from this. We're going to see that kind of detail that basically is handed to these stenographer journalists by intelligence assets of Western agencies and Israeli ones.
Green light.
You've got to take these with a pinch of salt. It is part of the PR war. It is part of the, we're in the driver's seat right now that Israel wants to keep going for as long as possible because a response is coming. And one of these narratives is, and that we've even heard in Lebanon, is that the Iranians sold Hezbollah out, okay? They sold them out in exchange for some nuclear deal, from sanctions relief, et cetera, et cetera. Let me just say something, okay? I'm just going to give you an example that is rock solid, 100% proven. So Imad Bouhnieh, who is the mastermind of a lot of Hezbollah's military strategies in his lifetime and after he was assassinated, was killed in a car bomb in Damascus in February 2008. In the immediate aftermath of that assassination of Imad Bouhnieh, the most senior military commander of Hezbollah, the U.S. Director of National Intelligence, Mike McConnell, misdirected reporters, and this was reported widely. He said, in quote, there's some evidence that it may have been internal Hezbollah. It may have been Syria, okay, which immediately seeded doubt, paranoia, suspicion within this region, within the Axis, within potentially Hezbollah, within potentially Syria. 7 years later, in a series of orchestrated leaks to Newsweek magazine, Washington Post, on the same day, articles revealed that the Mulnia car bombing came courtesy of a joint operation by the CIA and Mossad, okay, confirmed by the U.S. government and the Israeli government. So 8 years prior, they had said it could have been Hezbollah, it could have been Syria. It's the same thing with the assassination of Rafiq Hariri. It could have been Syria, then it could have been Hezbollah. They did this, all right? So now this information that an Iranian mull provided this intelligence on how to kill Nasrallah and the top Hezbollah command is now being seeded. So you've got to disregard that immediately. The U.S. always blames things it does itself on others. For instance, the assassination attempt, which killed 80 people on Ayatollah Mohammad Hussein Fadlallah in Lebanon, which was organized by CIA Director William Casey. He gave an interview on his deathbed, basically, to the Washington Post, where he said that he arranged for Saudi funding for the covert operation using Lebanese militias to do the dirty work, okay? But, of course, it wasn't the Americans. For decades, it wasn't the Americans. This is the U.S. Modus operandi. I mean, even, the Americans talk about Hezbollah being the biggest terrorist organization, blaming Hezbollah for the bombing of the Marine barracks in Lebanon in 1982 and then the U.S. Embassy bombing in 1983. The U.S. Secretary of Defense at the time of the bombings, Caspar Weinberger, told PBS almost two decades later, in 2001, quote, "We still do not have the actual knowledge of who did the bombing of the Marine barracks at the Beirut airport, and we certainly didn't that." So it's all part of propaganda to lay the ground for justifying what they do. And it's a lie. It's a big fat lie. Just keep this in mind as events develop.
I mean, it's not a coincidence that as the attack that killed Nasrallah was taking place, the Israeli defense chief was on the phone with his U.S. counterpart. And there's also not a coincidence that apparently there were two airborne early warning and control planes off the coast of Beirut at the time of the attack, in which multiple Israeli F-35 were dropped.
U.S. airplanes. U.S. airplanes support aircraft to back up what they knew was going to be a massive fleet of Israeli fighter jets going to
talk. Essentially providing them defense, you know, like us.
Correct.
For any... well, I guess, counterattack. And you also have, you know, in all of the intelligence gathering that we already discussed, remember, for the past year, we have already seen multiple reports in Western media about the drones overflights of the UK Royal Air Force and the US Air Force across Lebanon on a daily basis, nonstop. So what's happening in Lebanon right now is being conducted by the Israeli army, the Israeli Air Force, but it couldn't be happening
without the Americans and the British.
Just like in Gaza.
And don't forget, the biggest British asset in the region is its Cyprus base. Basically, it's two areas of Cyprus in which the British government has sovereignty over Cypriot areas. And what were started off as British bases have now become joint British-American bases. And this is where they have their reconnaissance center for the entirety of West Asia, listening in on phone calls, eavesdropping, you know, interception of communications, et cetera, plus also launching operations and devising them, masterminding them. So the British are 100% involved in these things. And you know, these aircraft you're talking about that were in Lebanese airspace just before the bombing, yeah, what was a very rare thing. It hadn't happened in a long time. So the Americans are lying. The Israelis are lying. And the question really now lies, I think what probably people want to know is what is maybe our level of confidence, given that we speak to the players, all these players, all day long, what is our level of confidence in what's coming? So, well, okay, just quickly, again, to wrap up what we were saying, this idea that, like, it was an Iranian mole or it was this or that, again, what you were talking about, all the intelligence agencies at their disposal, all the militaries at their disposal. This is like, you don't need a spy when you're tracking someone's movements. And a lot of these leaders, including Syed Hassan Nasrallah, were in a very small area in the southern suburb of Beirut, Dahiyeh, almost within 2 square kilometers. So how hard is it really? I mean, I'm not downplaying what Israel did or underestimating their capabilities or their superiority. But it doesn't take a genius when you have these leaders in one area throughout the course of the whole war. And if you've been also gathering intel and tracking them maybe possibly for months, just like Hash Qasem Soleimani, they were also tracking him for months before they decided to exploit the opportunity and decide to assassinate in a time. So whether it's an Iranian mole or someone, I saw a report, someone shook hands with Saif Hassan Nasrallah and implanted something in his skin, another one about heartcrank technology, you know, it doesn't matter, Iranian mole, Lebanese mole, technology, it's a huge, in a way, tactical achievement for Israel. But also, I mean, the man, you know, didn't want to leave his neighborhood. The commanders wanted to be on the battleground there. They were probably had to meet in person, and so they did. And it's not, you know, that much. It's not rocket science. I mean, they were there. They were being tracked. So going into what comes next, this is an emotional time, and everyone needs an emotional response. But you have to remember, if Nain Asim just said that we are going to continue Hassan Nasrallah's plans, we all want to see hell rain down on, you know, the Israelis, right? But the thing is, we have to remember what the goal of this war is, which is to thwart Israel's goals, and which is to make sure the settlers don't go man to the north. That comes before. And just to be clear, you know, the revenge for the assassination of this larger-than-life man, Hassan Nasrallah, is the end of Israel and no less. So don't expect to see a contained response or a specific operation that is the official response to the assassination of the man that is Hassan Nasrallah, which is not just a military strategist, not just a political commentator, a spiritual leader and a father figure.
and a source of security and safety for the whole region, actually, and not just this country. So that's, you know, we are going to feel, a lot of people feel very defeated right now. Others are trying to keep the morale high because the reality does not change. And I still say Israel and the U.S. will fail at this new Middle East project, no matter how big these blows are. So whatever's coming, if it's not to the people's desire, doesn't mean that it's not to our benefit.
I think, you know, given that Nahum Parson said we're going to absolutely follow through with the Nasrallah strategy, and it wasn't, many of these are strategies we won't have known about, right, and will not hear about. But just to direct our viewers, if you want to know what Hassan Nasrallah's last speech was about, because it really, really addressed many of the situations in Lebanon today, and I think, you know, his speech was done after the pager terror attack and Israel's daily escalation on Lebanon, so it's very fresh still. Please, you know, look on our YouTube channel at one of our Cradle Bites from last week, which goes through the entirety of Hassan Nasrallah's speech and sums up the key points, because I think it's very important. We should be doing that too to refresh our memory, because those words are going to ring in our ears and apply to many situations looking ahead. I also want to take this moment to ask our viewers to please become a paying subscriber to Patreon. There's no time that we've needed your support more than now for many reasons. I mean, some are logistical, some are operational that I don't want to get into because who knows who's watching. We want to bring more content to you, but our situation is getting more difficult as, I mean, our neighborhoods are filling up. You know, people are basically staying everywhere.
Displays.
One million displays. So some include Cradle employees, Cradle staffers, our social media teams, and others who have also been hit. Their homes have been hit. So please, we really, really do need our viewers to become Patreon subscribers. I appreciate that.
So just to go back quickly to what we're discussing, which is what's next, right, in this war, in the terms of the resistance axis, I believe following the assassination of Hassan Nasrallah, we've already started to see a bit of the response, first of all, from Lebanon, that over the weekend launched, as it has been doing over the past months, heavy rocket barrages towards the north of Israel, one of which reportedly caused a serious security incident among military leaders in Israel. We don't have the information because Israel, you know, it's very good at censoring what goes out. We also had Yemen launch a ballistic missile that they say was aimed at the Ben Gurion airport as Netanyahu was coming back from the UN. It was shot down overnight. There was also a Lebanese ballistic missile fired towards Israel that was also shut down. You have the Islamic resistance in Iraq that has also been intensifying its attacks against Israel, hitting the port of Haifa, hitting certain settlements, but also apparently hitting the Conoco oil field, the U.S. occupation base, the Conoco oil field in northeast Syria. So this is kind of not more than what we've seen so far for the past year, but also it's obviously that it's they're coming together in a way, right? These attacks. Do you think we're going to see more of these? Do you think at some point this is actually going to be like the gates of hell open against Israel? Or is it going to be still like two separate fronts?
I'm not sure. That's, as I was saying earlier, I think with the main goal being, emotions aside, the main goal being to thwart their goals and to continue what Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah intended with this support front that was opened on 8 October. I can't say where this will go, but these are the support fronts. They will do what they can. And they are all paying the price for standing with Gaza. And Lebanon is under attack with hundreds dead and 1 million displaced and people having lost their homes and people under severe psychological pressure and severe psychological warfare. All of this is the price at the moment for standing with Gaza. Just like Yemen's Hodeidah port was bombed, this is the price for standing with Gaza. So we have to stay aware of what the initial goals are for this war. And again, I just wanted to say something quickly, is that this idea of when is this going to blow up into an all-out war and should it or should it not, or so much talking about Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah should have from day one gone all in on what, you know, on October 8th, they should have stormed the Galilee, they should have gone all in with the And all this wouldn't have happened because we would have had deterrence. You know, at one point I thought that too, but then I said, both ways Israel's going to rain down hell on you. If you do another October 7 by storming the Galilee, if you bring out all your weapons at the start of the war, you will pay the same price as if you have this strategic patience that we have seen practiced by the Axis. So it, either way, Israel is going to unleash itself and show its true face, because it's fighting an existential war. So, you know, we can speculate all we want. We are not the ones, we are not the commanders in the battlefield. And it's a very emotional time. But what I know is Israel will fail at its goals. That's what I can tell you for now.
I mean, it's already failing at the goals. I mean, come on. It's been, we're a week removed from it being the 1 year anniversary of the genocide in Gaza. Israel has not defeated Hamas. Israel has not recovered all of its captives. Israel has not regained the terrorists. I mean, yes, Gaza is flattened. I feel like I say this every week.
We have to.
Like, Gaza is flattened. The civilian population is under extreme duress. This is not a military achievement, right? To go against civilians, to cause terror, to kill children, to starve the entire population of the strip, it's not a military achievement.
Okay, and it's taking from us the most valuable man in our region and the most valuable in our hearts, Hassan Nasrallah, is also not a military achievement. It's a tactical achievement.
Exactly.
I am not downplaying it, but it is not a military achievement.
It's not.
It is not.
Like, exactly. You know, what they're doing in Lebanon, and this is actually where it gets, very concerned, honestly, that Israel, over the past year, has managed to do all of this in Gaza with complete impunity. Okay, some countries cut relations, the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, blah, 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 all of these things. You know, people walk out of Netanyahu's speech. It has meaning up to a point, you know, it has a significance, but it doesn't change anything either. So Israel just has been doing it with full impunity, and now they are coming with the very same strategy of Lebanon, right? A UN member state, a country that is aligned with the United States, just dropping bombs, just causing terror, killing leaders, right? Hassan Nasrallah, a fixture of Lebanese society for the past 30 years, love him or hate him, even the people, you know, that I have known that never liked Hassan Nasrallah, even they said, you know, this is not how we should have ended for him. You know, this was not right, because it's not right, you know, and you cannot just go and bomb a residential neighborhood and attempt to kill one person. But that's the Israeli strategy, right? What they call the 100-to-1. We can kill up to 100 civilians if it means we kill one commander. In this case, we still don't even know how many civilians they killed in that attack. The goal here in Lebanon, as we're saying, is to return the settlers to the north.
Well, that's what they claim, but they actually want to disable Hezbollah. And now in the media, they say, oh, they only have 10% firing capability left. And we know that's not true. They are committing massacres in the Bakar, in the Hirman, in the south, in Beirut. So no, and you know, just like I said, you can't separate Lebanon from Gaza. You can't separate Lebanon from Hezbollah. They are trying to disentangle Lebanon from Hezbollah. Oh, we're not in a war against the Lebanese people. We're just in a war against Lebanon. Hezbollah is an integral part of Lebanon and is found all across Lebanon. You cannot disentangle them. And no, they are not a terrorist organization. So this is a war on Lebanon.
No, the terrorists are the ones that are like blowing up, you know, communication devices in people's pockets, no matter if they're in a car, no matter if they're in a plane,
right,
no matter if they're with their children. That's terrorism. And what we have seen over the past year is that there's only a very few who would stand up against the actual terrorism, against the actual genociders, and against, you know, the mass murderers. And it is Hezbollah, and it is Hamas, and it is Ansar Allah, and it is the Iraqi resistance, and it is, you know, Iran, to maybe not an active role, but obviously not a support role, right? Because all of these factions, they wouldn't be what they wouldn't have the capabilities that they have if it wasn't for the Islamic Republic. But the world doesn't work like that, right? Everyone is a terrorist. You know, even the cradle was accused of supporting terrorism just to silence us. Why? Because we stand on the side of Gaza. We stand on the side of Lebanon. We stand on the side of truth.
Well, Hassan Nasrallah stood up not only to Israeli and U.S. terrorism, but to the agenda they want to impose on the region. And, you know, this, like you said, a lot of people said this isn't how it should have ended for him. And a lot of people are feeling like he was stolen from us too soon. But the fact is, there's a very spiritual dimension to all of this, and you cannot understand Hezbollah without understanding that. But the fact is, it is an honor to be martyred in support of Gaza and being one of the only ones who refused to stand down.
Exactly.
And that is really, you know, one day people who aren't capable of seeing it from that perspective will see it. It is an honor, okay, because that is the whole path of, you know,
exactly.
It's indisputable. So as difficult as it is.
Since the day of his death, you know, I've been going back to two quotes that I'm going to paraphrase, but they were like from the past couple of speeches. And one of them was after Fuad Shukr was killed. And he said, you know, that obviously this was a huge loss, and that everyone from the organization of Hezbollah knows that that they can face their death in point, right? That martyrdom is their finish line, so to speak. And the other one was after the Beijer attacks, in which he said that some days the victory will be on the end. And like, we're not going to win every day. They're not going to win every day. This is a long war of attrition.
Yeah.
So I think those are things that are really, you know, that are, I guess, for the colonizing mind, is impossible to understand, right? They think they can just come, kill a leader, and then the movement's going to crumble. It's not, because it's an idea. It's part of your life. So one last thing before we end for this week, and is this statement from the Iraqi resistance in Iraq that falls into the idea, right, of maybe a united front. A few days ago, a leader from the resistance in Iraq, Ali Ahmadi, spoke with a Lebanese newspaper, Al-Ahbar. Well, first of all, that the resistance fully be prepared to go, if necessary, to go into Lebanon. He also said we are ready for open war against Israel. And then a very interesting quote, he called the UAE, in particular, the advanced position of the Zionist entity in the Gulf, and said that the UAE will be the first line of fire for the resistance. Now, this obviously goes back to what you were talking about earlier in this episode, Sima, which is Netanyahu standing at the UN with, you know, the blessing and the curse. The blessing being Israel and all the normalized states, the curse being everyone else. So what is the UAE, what are these normalizing states that that are, you know, in such friendly relations with Israel, can we expect for them to become, you know, part of another front in this war? Do you think we're likely to see any of these states be targeted by the resistance? Because, well, in particular with the UAE, we know for a fact that they've been helping Israel, you know, with their commerce and their trade. And, you know, you have Jordan that has been so ready to come to the defense of Israel. You have Saudi Arabia. There was this quote from Mohammed bin Salman a few days ago, in which he said, apparently he said...
But he doesn't care about the Palestinian issue.
Yeah, like, personally, I don't care, is what he says. So what are they also now looking down the barrel of a gun?
The Iraqi resistance actually, I don't know if you remember the Tower 22 drone attack in Jordan, when the U.S. base was hit in Jordan, and we were under the impression that it was an accident. I still don't believe it was an accident, but it was after then that things were, they were requested to tone things down, and then we saw a decline in attacks against the U.S. Bases in Iraq and Syria by the Iraqi resistance. So we've already seen a bit of this, and we might see that go to a next stage. I'm not sure how many operations like that we'd see or where that would lead or at what time that would come. But I think it depends where things go. But I think from what we've seen, you might see the UAE or Jordan, being targeted by the Iraqi or Yemeni forces. We might see that, but I don't know at what point. And I think it would be like an exceptional situation.
But maybe this is just more of a warning, right? Maybe.
Yeah. I mean, we've heard these warnings from Yemen before.
But Yemen in particular has hit UAE, has hit Saudi Arabia, because it's where the countries waged protest.
I mean, I take Yemen more seriously. I think with Iraq, they've contributed a lot as a support front and have developed their capabilities throughout the war, like Yemen has. I'm not belittling that, but I take the kind of threat of something like hitting the UAE more seriously from the Yemeni armed forces than I do from the Iraqis. I think a lot of what the Iraqis do, although it's important, a dimension of it is the moral support and trying to make a point and trying to, they might do it, but, you know, targeting is one thing and actually hitting the target is another thing.
Well, true.
So we might see that. I mean, I really don't know where we're going right now. I'm not going to pretend that we know where we're going.
No, this is a completely, you know.
All I know is that strategically, Israel and the U.S. will fail in what they want for the region. But I don't know how this escalation exactly will pan out. All I know is there's going to be, it's going to be a struggle.
Yeah. And let's not forget that the escalation, despite, what you always see in Western media, when they talk about the escalation, You know, if Iran retaliates, it's because they're escalating. If Lebanon retaliates, it's because they're escalating. But when Israel comes and bombs, you know, the capital of another country, of a neighboring country, and kills hundreds of people, that's not escalation. That's self-defense. This is what we've been taught. And this is where we will end it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. Please make sure to share, to like, to subscribe, and to follow us on Telegram and on X, and to check out our Patreon, where our subscribers will be able to listen to an extended version of this podcast, where we will also discuss Israeli plans for the ground offensive in Lebanon. What can we expect of them? So please make sure to check that out. For the Cradle News Roundup, my name is Esteban Carrillo. This week I was joined by Sharmin Awani and Simon Itay.
Welcome back, and that was the Cradle panel discussion on the current situation in Lebanon. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast. We've been broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit on this Friday, October the 4th, 2024. That's going to conclude our program for today. If you'd like to have access to this program, go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. We'll close out with the music of Carmen McRae. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
Thank you very, very much. That old black magic that you weave so well. That old black magic that you feel so well. Those acid fingers up and down my spine. The same old witchcraft when your eyes meet mine. The same old tingle that I feel inside. And then the elevator starts its ride. And down and down I go, round and round I go, like a leaf that's going to die. I could stay away, but what can I do? I hear your name, and I'm a flame with a burning desire that only a kiss can put out the fire. You are the lover I have waited for. You're the mate that I was created for. And every time your lips meet mine, darling, down and down I go, round and round I go, in a spin loving that. Now, man, I'm under that old black magic called love, the magic called love.
Gotta stick to my tune. Stick to my tune that I get along without you very well. Of course I do. Except perhaps in spring. For I must never think of spring. For that would surely break my heart. Whenever skies look gray to me and trouble begins to brew, whenever the winter winds become too strong, I concentrate on you. When fortune cries nay, nay to me and people declare whenever the blues become my only song, straight on you, on your smile, so sweet, so tender. When at first your kiss I declined, on the light in your eyes, when I surrendered, and all at once our arms entwined. And so when wise men say to me that love's young dream never comes true, to prove that even wise men can be wrong, I concentrate on sha do 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 do. Your kiss I decline, on the light in your eyes, when I surrender, and all at once, our arms intertwine. And so, when wise men say to me that love's young dream never ever comes, to prove that even wise men can be wrong, I concentrate on you. I concentrate and I concentrate on. Concentrate on you. Love came on stealthy fingers and took me by surprise. I fell against my wishes, though I was wise, oh, 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 so wise. For love to me was not a total stranger. I've seen it come and go and come again. I know the sweetness and I know the danger. And oh yeah, I know the pain. Love came. That old
My heart.